who came, even though it's kind of rainy outside. I wanted to make sure you all know that I've posted the first question for homework two, so that's going to be due next week on Thursday. There'll be more questions, but the first one you can do already based on yesterday's lecture. It's about backpropagation, so whenever you want to try that one out, you can go ahead. And I'll post the rest of that assignment after tomorrow's lecture, because you'll need to know the material that we covered today and a bit of the, well, not really the tutorial actually, but today's lecture and tomorrow's lecture will be needed for the homework to do the last two parts. Another announcement I have is that tomorrow, Roger Malko's group, he's a professor here that does a lot of work in machine learning, and he has a fairly big group that works on this stuff. His group is having a group meeting tomorrow afternoon. And so they've extended the invitation to this class if you guys are interested in seeing what they're talking about. Estelle, who's sitting on this class, she's going to give the group meeting tomorrow. And I think she's going to talk about, what are you talking about?
Some relationship with machine learning. Why should Monte Carlo?
So she's going to talk about a certain kind of Monte Carlo, and it's actually a really good fit, I think, with this class, because tomorrow we're going to talk about Monte Carlo in the morning's lecture, so I think her tutorial will be really great. So it's not at all mandatory. It won't be needed for any of the tutorials or homeworks, but I'll send you guys all the information about that, just in case you're interested in attending that.
I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but would you please turn on your microphone?
Yes, sorry.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. Just one other thing I want to make sure I mention so I don't forget. Just today, I actually have to leave right at 10. I have to go to another meeting. So usually I stay after class and I talk with some of you, some questions. So, but luckily we have tutorial today. So just I won't be able to stay after 10. So just if you have questions, just like keep them in mind and just we'll talk about them during the tutorial for sure. And definitely ask questions during class. As soon as it's over, I'll need to leave. So. Okay, so today I want to kind of continue with something we talked about yesterday, which is looking at how to separate our data into different data sets. So today we'll actually talk about this a little bit further, and we'll talk about three different types of data sets: training, validation, and testing data sets. Then we'll talk about methods that prevent overfitting. So these data sets help us recognize if we're overfitting our data. And then we'll talk about methods we could actually use to make that better. And then, after all of this, we're finally going to get back to talking about physics. So we talked about applications to physics in the first lecture, but since Tuesday, we've really just been talking about machine learning methods. So I want to start talking about examples where we can actually use these supervised neural networks to learn about phases of matter. So specifically, we'll talk about the Ising model, which we kind of talked about a little bit in lecture one, but I'll just give you a bit more details about that because you're going to do that for homework two. And then I'll also talk about the Ising gauge theory, which is a phase of matter that's more difficult to learn. And so we're going to do a tutorial about the gauge theory today and also on next week, the tutorial next week. We'll do two tutorials about this case because it's fairly difficult to learn. Okay, so what I've written on the board here is basically a summary of what I wrote yesterday, except that I was reading a little bit more yesterday, and I realized that I think we should, instead of me saying testing data yesterday, I should have said validation data. I think depending where you read, some people would say testing data the way that I said it, because I've certainly seen that before. But I want to introduce this third data set called validation data, and it'll make more sense if yesterday's notes say validation instead of testing. So even though you might kind of see these sometimes used interchangeably, let's just change that in the notes. And I'll upload a new version of yesterday's notes that just changes that word everywhere. Yesterday we talked about dividing our data into two sets. This was going to help us prevent overfitting. I'll just kind of review that now. Now I just want to say that we can actually do further analysis if we divide into three sets. So what we talked about yesterday is that when we look at our training data, which is what you guys did in the first tutorial, we know that this data is used to help us adjust our weights and biases. So as you were training, for example, in tutorial one, if you plotted your training accuracy as a function of your training epoch, so how long you had been training, you should see that this training accuracy is always going up, or maybe it plateaus and it stays the same, but it doesn't usually go down. It's usually always getting better. But then we saw that in this tutorial, we noticed cases where it probably should have stopped. We probably shouldn't have had this continuing to go up because it was really fitting to noise in this training data. So it was overfitting this data. And then if we wanted to extend to other data sets, it wouldn't generalize very well. So that's why we introduced this concept of a second data set, which I initially called testing data, but let's now call it validation data. And so this is used to diagnose overfitting in our training data. So if I were to, at this, after I plot the training accuracy, I could also calculate the validation accuracy. And I could plot it as well as a function of epoch. I would often see that this accuracy would initially go up as the network is learning. But at some point, the network would start overfitting. And so this validation accuracy would go down because this data is data that was never seen during training. So once this one goes down, I can tell that I'm overfitting. So that's something we talked about yesterday. But if you guys have questions, please let me know. Okay. So inspired by a question that Katie asked yesterday, I want to talk about a third type of data set that we can ask, that we can introduce. So the idea is that after we look at these two kinds of plots, we might see that maybe this accuracy is not actually very high. Maybe the peak accuracy that it reaches, we want to try to do better. So we could then adjust the hyperparameters of our network, and we could do this whole procedure again. Okay, so since we have this validation accuracy to kind of measure how well we're doing, this from the peak validation accuracy, we could keep adjusting the hyperparameters in our network, like the learning rate or the number of layers or some of these momentum parameters. There's all the other hyperparameters we haven't talked about yet. There's many, many hyperparameters. We could adjust some of those, try training again, and see if we reach a higher peak in our validation accuracy. So does anyone see why we might introduce a third data set, something that could be a problem that could happen by doing this procedure? So there's a second level of overfitting that could go on. So think we're trying to adjust these hyperparameters, right? But we're tuning those hyperparameters based on our validation accuracy. So there can be a whole other level of overfitting of our hyperparameters to our validation data set. So it could be that we've tuned our hyperparameters and they actually only really work well for that specific validation data set. So we want to make sure that we've actually tuned our hyperparameters in a way that could be general to other data sets as well. So if we want to be really proper, then in the end, if we were wanting to report how well this network did for a certain type of data, we wouldn't really want to say that we can reach you know, 80% accuracy using our validation data set, because maybe it's actually a little bit worse than that if we look at a data set that wasn't used to tune the hyperparameters. So if you're reading a paper and they quote the accuracy that they can reach, they should really do this for a testing data set, which has never been used in either of these procedures. So this testing data set should not have been used to adjust your weights and biases, and it also shouldn't have been used to adjust your hyperparameters. Yeah?
It seems like the testing data is really expensive to create, right? Because, like, otherwise you would just, like, you have to do it by hand to, or otherwise you would have an algorithm that just solves it, right? And then you wouldn't have to use machine learning. So then why are we using so many sets of testing data if it's, like, the whole point is to find an algorithm that, like, gives you the answer?
Right, that gives you, yeah, that's a good point. So actually, no, it's not more expensive than the other types of data, though. So really, we take some big data set that we have that, you know, initially what we were talking about, we might have been thinking about only using it for training. Then we started thinking, let's divide it in two. You will use most of that data for training, but we'll save a little bit to do these checks at the end. Right. So it's,
but all the training data is expensive, right? Because it has to be labeled by hand rather than by the algorithm.
It depends. I guess the idea is that supervised learning would be very useful in cases where this generation is expensive. So in doing supervised learning, you still need to generate enough data that you can label it in some way. Maybe in lots of cases that would be expensive. What was I going to say? Sorry. And then the idea is that, yeah, we could eventually train a network that would produce this data faster in an ideal case. That's what we're trying to do. Yeah, you guys.
Okay, so I think the answer to your question is that data usually comes labeled. That's the assumption here. By other people who have labeled it.
Yeah, but that's the point. Like, someone has to label it. It's like, it doesn't matter whether it's you or your undergrad.
Yeah,
like,
sure, that's
what. No, I mean, not necessarily. So actually, you're right. In some cases, people might label it by hand. So when people look at these handwritten digits, then yeah, they've labeled it by hand. They've said, I just drew a zero. I'm going to label this as a zero.
If you have an algorithm to label it, then there's no point in using machine learning to create an algorithm to label it.
Yeah, so in the end, you're right. Absolutely. But we're actually going to look at cases where we do generate the labels using another algorithm. So when we look at the icing model, for example, we already know all the properties of the icing model, right? We're not aiming to use machine learning to learn something new about the icing model, but we have all these labels for our icing model. So in this case, we are going to have a lot of labels and a lot of data. Here, we're just trying to understand how machine learning works on this type of physics data, even though we have a data set. But you're absolutely right. In a lot of cases, getting labels for our data could be very expensive and very difficult. And that's why in a lot of applications, people use unsupervised learning, where there's no labels. And that's what we're going to talk about next week. So you're right. That's actually a big problem. And that's kind of why we want to introduce these data sets, because in a lot of applications, people don't have big enough data sets, because it can be really expensive to generate that data and really difficult to label it. So, you know, in an ideal case, I'd have, you know, millions of data points, and I could easily do this and make sure I'm not overfitting. But in a lot of applications, it's so expensive to get that. So I have a very limited data set. So you kind of have to play around with how much you use for training and how much you're using to verify that it worked. So this is still important, but this is a really great point. And I think we're gonna see a lot of other methods next week that don't rely on having these labels. Yeah.
What are the relative sizes of training, testing, validation?
Yeah, you can look up different rules of thumb. So I think this is, I mean, I guess in principle, this is another hyperparameter, how you split these up into three sets.
Right.
So I didn't look at a ton of references for what people recommend, but one place I was reading, people were using around 70% for training, I think, and then 20% for validation and 10% for testing.
Okay.
So something on this order, but people, depending who you talk to, people will find they'll use slightly different.
So more than a half is training?
I think in most cases, yeah. Did anyone else have another question? Okay. So, just to be clear,
sort of for physics.
So now let's talk about what we might do if we realized we were seeing a lot of overfitting and we wanted to try to find a way to improve that. So one pretty simple thing we can do is we can add regularization to our cost function. So it turns out that we can kind of control a little bit how much our network overfits by kind of penalizing it for having certain behavior in the weights. So let me just write out what we do and then I'll explain it. So what we do is we basically take the initial cost function that we started with and we add some term that sums over all weights in the network, either takes the absolute value or squares it. And then we have another hyperparameter that we introduce, lambda, that controls how much we add. Okay, so we know that we want to minimize the cost function. And so the effect of adding this term is basically going to be that our weights are going to be smaller, the network will at least favor smaller weights. So the effect that we expect to see is that our network now favors smaller weights. And what this means is that if we took our data that we had and we added some noise to it, it wouldn't have as large of an effect on the neural network's behavior in the end, which is basically what we're trying to have with overfitting. So this added noise wouldn't get multiplied by a very big number and then make it have a very large effect. This is the basic idea of adding this kind of term. Any questions about that? Okay, then I have a question for you guys. So if I make this parameter too small, am I going to overfit or underfit my data? I'm hearing some people say things, but no one's confident enough to say it louder. It's okay if you just guess.
If it's too small, nothing would change, right?
If it's too small, nothing change, and so you would be overfitting, right? Yeah, exactly. But if it's too big, we can underfit our data. So we have to be careful of that too. Because if it's too big, we're basically just going to be saying all these weights should be zero. And then our network is not actually really going to be able to learn very much. It's going to underfit the data.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Why do we put utilization just on the weights and not on the weights and biases?
That's a good question. So I guess you probably could do something with the biases too. But the weights are, I guess, what multiplies your, the bias is just kind of a shift. It's like, at what level do I want to have, you know, if I have a perceptron, the bias is just kind of, at what point do I want to shift from on to off? Or in sigmoid, it has a similar interpretation. It's like, roughly, where is the middle of this? So I don't think it has the same interpretation of affecting the noise as the weights do, because the weights multiply the noise. So you could see if you have noise in your data, that that noise will get multiplied directly by your weight. I think that's the argument. There might be, maybe there's something you can do with the biases, though. Yeah?
Why do large weights imply overfitting? Like, I would think maybe the ratios of weights, like the relative sizes of weights may matter, but why do we just...
Oh, you mean... Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that's a good question. So I guess that's why we have this hyperparameter here that can account for the, like, you're probably right that it's all about things on a relative scale in the end, but wouldn't that be accounted for by this? Maybe that's, I don't know if that's right, yeah.
Also, and there's usually a pre-processing step involved, so you usually take your data and normalize it to some unit range between 0 and 1, so absolute weights of the data, absolute values of the weights would be representative of how much things blow up unwantedly.
So they're already on a scale. So.
Yeah, it's already normalized in such a way to have this be meaningful. Okay.
But, I mean, so that would help you, because then you'd probably have an idea of this hyperparameter, but I'm not sure that you actually would need to do that. Like, I think if you can adjust this hyperparameter, you kind of have to play with adjusting it more if it's not normalized. But, I mean, if your data is just unnormalized, this is basically your normalization factor, I think. Okay, so the one more method I want to talk about. It's called dropout. And the idea here is that when we're running our training, we're actually going to ignore some of our neurons in our hidden layer. So, just to kind of show you what it looks like. If this was my network that I'm running, I just drew a really small, simple example. And the idea is that while I'm training, at various training steps, I would just randomly choose some neurons in the hidden layer, and I would just not use them in training. I would only adjust the other ones. So I would only process information through these ones and only backpropagate through these ones as well.
Plus.
So if I do this procedure, the idea is that the effect of dropping out some of my neurons would be similar to as if I were to train my data on many different neural networks and then average over the result. That's kind of what we're doing here. On every step, every training step, every time we apply a new masking, the network looks a little bit different. So it kind of has this averaging effect. And so each of these networks that I average over might kind of overfit in a different way. So then I'm averaging over all these different kinds of overfitting that I could possibly have. And in a lot of cases, you'll see that this will improve overfitting. Do you guys want to ask anything about this? Yeah.
So from these last two points, I feel like the idea is that either the weights or the neurons should pretty much be kind of equally weighted in the final model.
Well, so that's why. Well, that's why we have to play with adjusting this hyperparameter, because I think you're right that if we took the weights to, if we took this parameter to be too big, then that would be the effect. But remember that we still have this whole other portion of our cost function, right? That's measuring how good our output is relative to our labels. So depending on how big this parameter is, we're going to weight this effect in different ways. So if this is very small, then it's just going to kind of encourage that in a very small way. But it's still going to mostly, it still might, there might be cases where, you know, the maybe the weights really need to be different in some cases. And it, the only way to minimize our cost function is to do that. As long as we're careful with this hyperparameter, we can still have that.
That also has the same effect, right? If you remove some neurons that previously had a pretty big weight, then suddenly your model looks totally different.
Totally. And that's why you have to... Yeah, so the hyperparameter you have to play with here is basically how what percentage of neurons you mask out. So you're right, if I'm masking out half of them and a few of those neurons are really important, then I'm going to be ignoring them half the time. But if I'm only masking out 10%, then in most cases, I'll still see the effect of some of those bigger weights, right? So you're absolutely right. Everything you're saying is correct. It's just that you can have that effect just to a very small degree if you make these hyperparameters smaller. So you're kind of trying to find the right balance between representing your data and not overfitting, or overfitting and underfitting your data, right? So the point is that if I don't do any of these things, I might overfit my data in a lot of cases. So but maybe in some cases I have the perfect network already and it's not going to overfit. Well, then I don't want to do these things, right? These are just things you can do if you're overfitting.
Okay, so I understand that it's a small effect, but is there this idea that the neurons or the weights, should all of them mostly have the same weight, or no, that's not the case?
I don't think they should all have the same weight. It's more the idea that like all of the responsibility of describing your data shouldn't be in one neuron. So if it was all up to this neuron to do all the work, then what's the point of having all these other neurons in my layer? In that case, I would probably want to just have like a smaller number of hidden neurons. So there is, in that sense, I guess we don't want to have one neuron being having much huger weights than every other one. Yeah.
The size of the weights depends on the architecture and the inputs. Like if you're trying to determine the color of an object and one of the inputs is the shape of the object, then that weight would be irrelevant to your output, right? So then in that case, the weight would be small.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it really depends on what your input is, what the architecture is of the network.
So you're saying you think one neuron could be responsible for... I think because people.
Depending on what you're trying to do, right?
Yeah, I mean the way I often see people, you might be right, and I mean people make these arguments about different parts of the network describing different features, and I think sometimes it's true. It's maybe not always as well defined as people would lead you to believe in some of these things. But the way I usually see it is more that one layer would be responsible for doing that. So I think in that case you're absolutely right that maybe the weights in if I only drew one hidden layer here, but I could have many. Maybe the weights in this layer could be a different magnitude than the weights in the next layer. I think maybe that would be more what you're talking about. Yeah?
For the dropout, it seems like we're assuming that the bias kind of averages to zero. But
oh, that's a good point. I never thought about that.
I don't actually know how you would quantify that, but I'm just...
Yeah, I have to think about that more. That's a really interesting point, though. You might be right. I'm not sure. This might assume that your average bias is zero. I'm trying to think. Maybe that assumption is okay. Yeah, I'll look into that, and maybe we can talk about it more tomorrow. Because, that's a really cool point. That maybe this is somehow right. Yeah. Yeah, well, let me think about it. Anything else? These are good questions. Yeah.
Can you use the sign how many, the number of how many hidden layers?
Can you say again? Sorry.
Can you use the sign how many number of hidden layers?
Sorry, I heard the end of your question was number of hidden layers, but I just didn't hear the beginning.
Okay. User assigned.
User assigned? Is the number, are you saying, do I have to choose how many hidden layers?
Yes.
Yeah. That's another hyperparameter. So how many hidden layers, how many neurons you have in each layer, this is a choice. And so as I add more hidden layers, this is the idea of making my network deeper. So when people talk about deep learning, they're talking about having more layers that you propagate through. And there's different studies that people do on in various types of data on whether it's better to have more layers or just more neurons. So if I decide I'm going to have 100 hidden neurons, I can put them in one layer or I could spread them out in 20 layers, whatever, I can do whatever I want. And people have done different tests, and I think it depends on the nature of your data. In some cases, people find that it's better to have more hidden layers, and in some cases, they find it's better to just put all the neurons in one layer. So, yeah, it's another hyperparameter. Okay, so let's now talk about physics. So we'll go back to talking about this problem of learning about phases of matter using supervised learning. For this, a lot of what we're going to talk about is based on a paper by Juan Carrasquilla and Roger Malko that was in 2016, so not even 3 years ago this paper was put out. And this was really a paper that was one of the papers that really started this field of using machine learning for many body physics. And so a lot of the focus of this paper is just on using machine learning for the icing model. And a lot of people might say, why would we do that? Why would we care? We already know everything about the icing model. But really, I just want to emphasize that machine learning is something that was not previously really used in this area of many-body physics. So of course, we want to benchmark it and make sure that we understand how it works in these simple cases. So maybe we understand the features of the icing model, but we don't understand how machine learning works in describing the icing model. So we're going to build up that understanding on the icing model and the gauge theory, which we already know a lot of the physics behind. And the aim is that someday we'll be able to use these methods in cases where other methods fail. So when machine learning is really, we're going to figure out what are the cases, hopefully, where machine learning is really advantageous in comparison with other methods. So we already talked about this a bit on Monday, but let's just write again the Hamiltonian for the classical icing model. So in the classical case of this model, my degrees of freedom are just +1 or -1. I think on Monday I wrote 0 and 1, but I'm going to use +1 and -1 today because in the code, I think that the code I've written is using this notation. So let's just use this way. Thank you. So we can talk about an icing model on any type of lattice. But in all of these cases, this model is describing degrees of freedom on the sites of the lattice, whereas other models, they'll be on the bonds of the lattice. So let's, as we did the other day, let's talk about the 2D square lattice. So I kind of also want to just talk a little bit about how we implement this and store the information that we need on a computer. So in doing that, it's really important to adopt some labeling of our sites. So in the code that I've written that you guys are going to work with for some of these different models, I use the convention usually of starting, if I were to draw the lattice like this, I would think of kind of like going along one row and then going up to the next one. So labeling 1 to 4 and then 5, 6, etc. So this model on this two-dimensional square lattice is, we know that it has a phase transition in the thermodynamic limit at a critical temperature of 2.269 J. So I wrote this on Monday, but I'll just write it again. So if I'm below the critical temperature, I'm in my ferromagnetic phase. And above the critical temperature, I'm in a paramagnetic phase. And so we can see now, having learned all that we have about supervised learning, that this easily can translate into labels of our states. And in some sense, you know, we might imagine that some problems like this could even be easier than some other ones we've looked at, because we only have two labels that we're trying to distinguish, right? 0 and 1. We're not trying to distinguish 10 different classes of handwritten digits. It's just two labels that we want to learn. And so one of you had a really nice way of asking a question the other day that I liked. Someone said, why would we use machine learning for the icing model when we already have a perfect classifier? And that perfect classifier is our magnetization. So if I calculate the magnetization, if it's finite, if it's not zero, I know I'm in the ferromagnetic phase. And if it's zero, I know I'm in the paramagnetic phase. We know this from theory, and this works perfectly. So basically, I don't want you to think of us as trying to learn more about the icing model. We're trying to ask ourselves, can machine learning learn the order parameter? Or can it learn something other than the order parameter to distinguish phases? I'll write here. Um. So I just want to emphasize that we want to see if we can learn these features without telling our neural network anything about the features of the theory here. So we don't want to tell it anything about the Hamiltonian or the order parameter, and we're going to see if it can learn to distinguish these phases. Yeah.
Isn't it sort of a, I mean, like, I understand the question of, like, can our neural network, like, learn a physics thing, I guess. But in this case, aren't you just asking, like, can my neural network take an average? Which,
yeah.
Like, the whole like, setup of the neural network lends itself to averages.
Mm-hmm. No, you're absolutely right. So we are going to see this problem is actually really easy for neural networks to do. Well, one thing that's maybe not as easy, which I think is really cool about what this paper did, is that when you're at a finite size lattice, you don't actually have a phase transition, right? You only have a phase transition in the thermodynamic limit. And if you try to measure your magnetization on a finite size lattice, it doesn't actually go to zero anywhere, right? It's going to be smoothed out in some way. So it's not going to perfectly just classify using the magnetization. It does something else. But whenever we want to use theory to extract our critical temperature or our critical exponents in these theories, we need to use this notion of finite size scaling, which is the fact that the physics looks different on different length scales. And we have to take this into account. But things should become universal at a phase transition. And the really cool thing about this paper is that they're also able to extract critical exponents in doing that. So maybe that's more impressive than just classifying phases. So they can actually learn critical behavior of these systems using that. So you're right that maybe it's pretty obvious that it's going to be able to do some averaging. And in the other cases we'll look at, it's not just an averaging. The gauge theory, it's not that kind of order that it has. But I think, yeah, still the fact that it can learn some critical features of this is pretty cool, too. So yeah, maybe this right now is not so impressive, but there's other things that are cool about the icing model. There's a lot of papers on machine learning for the icing model. So people find ways to make it interesting. Yeah.
I guess this other point is, like, we're not putting in by hand, you know, we're not telling the network to do a particular thing. So we don't a priori know whether the feature it's going to pick up for distinguishing things we want to distinguish is the physical feature that we're using to distinguish them.
Yeah, totally.
So if you're looking at more complicated systems, that's kind of like the major problem with machine learning, right? It's you don't know whether it's using some physically relevant arguments to come up with the answer that it comes up with.
Right. And so maybe that can be a good thing and maybe it can be a bad thing. Like on the good side, maybe it's going to come up with a way of distinguishing phases that humans haven't thought of, right? Similar to how in like the game of Go, the neural networks came up with ways to play this game that humans just would never play it, right? Like we could maybe come up with ways of discovering new phases of matter that we wouldn't know how to do as humans. But you're right that sometimes we do want to respect certain physical constraints. And then people do all these different kinds of feature engineering in machine learning where they have different techniques for making sure that you respect certain physical symmetries in your model. You can do that. I guess at the purest level, you try not to tell your algorithms these physical features because you want to see if it can learn them. But in some cases, people do that. They do try to tune their models so that they will indeed respect some really physical certainty that you have. Okay, so just to show you what this is going to look like in the code. I'm going to just store these spins, the spin states, in a vector. So when you look at the code for the homework, I guess, you'll see, or also for the tutorials, you'll see something like this. And again, just to remind you, I'll just have two different labels, ferromagnetic or paramagnetic, and the code will write this as 0 or 1. Thank you. so for our cases, the data that we're going to use to train these networks is going to be from Monte Carlo simulation. You'll see in tomorrow's lecture, I'm going to explain how we do that. But that's the idea. Okay, any questions? Yeah?
Let's say if we have input data and we haven't told the system our Hamiltonian, like in any way. Mm-hmm. So is there any chance that we can derive or, let's say, approach a Hamiltonian if we have enough data points?
Oh, to get the Hamiltonian, to figure out figure out the actual form of the Hamiltonian?
Yeah,
I think some people work on that question, yeah. I don't know exactly how it works, but I've heard people talk about that before, that they try to figure out the Hamiltonian. I can see if I can try to find a reference for it. I don't know it off the top of my head, but I think that is something people, they're trying to learn the theory from the data, basically. Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about another model that for which the order parameter is not so easy to learn. So in this case, we have to sum over all plaquettes, or all the squares, on our lattice. And then take a product over the four spins that live on that plaquette. And again, our degrees of freedom are just plus and minus 1. But in this case, they live on the bonds of the lattice. For example, what we'll look at in the tutorial is the case where we have a two-dimensional system on a torus, so a square lattice with periodic boundary conditions. So I'm going to draw configurations like this, where if I draw a circle, it means that Si is plus 1. And if I leave it blank, it means Si is minus 1. I'm trying to go through this quickly because I still want to show you something on the slides. So, get through this on the slide. So, if I consider one plaquette P, I just want to make it really clear how we do this calculation, or how we would calculate the Hamiltonian in this case. So, if I have my sites labeled as K, L, M, and N, then in this case, the product over all of the over this plaquette would just be the product of these four spins. So that's what we're doing. We're summing over all squares of the lattice, and for each square, we take the product of all the spins there. So if I'm at very low temperatures, I'm going to prefer to have configurations where I have an even number of these dots on my lattice, so an even number of plus one spins, because then my product is going to be one, and my energy gets multiplied by a negative, so I'll minimize my energy best if I have an even number of up spins and an even number of down spins. So these are going to be the configurations that I favor at low temperatures. Okay, and if I have an odd number of these spins on a plaquette, then I'll call that excited. I'll write on this back one so I don't have to erase anything. So in this model, we actually don't have a finite temperature phase transition, but at exactly zero temperature, there's a topologically ordered ground state that we expect to find. So again, there's no order here at finite temperatures, but exactly at T equals zero, I'll find topological order. So to measure this topological order, what we have to do is we have to introduce a measure called the Wilson loop that goes across our whole system. And this is going to tell us whether or not we have topological order. So let me explain that. So one example is I could just take a loop that's a curve in the x direction, or I could take a curve in the y direction. And then my Wilson loop, I'll just calculate as the product over all spins touching this curve. So I'll just, in this case, I would take a product of all the spins on these bonds. And I'm just taking a product of plus and minus 1. So the answer will be plus or minus 1 in this case. And it turns out that if I'm in the ground state, these Wilson loops in the x and y directions are going to be the same no matter if I take where I take my curve in the x direction. So I could take my x curve to be here, here, here. I can even move it. It doesn't have to be horizontal. It just has to wrap around the x direction. In the topologically ordered phase, I'm always going to get the same value for this Wilson loop number. So just to emphasize, there's actually four different possibilities of how I can see topological order in this ground state. So no matter how I choose the CX curve, I'll either get plus or minus one, but it won't change. And I can have plus one in for the X and plus one for the Y. So I get four possibilities total. Any questions? Sorry for going fast through that. I just want to show you something that will just take 2 minutes on my computer. If I can get the screen down. And you guys can ask questions if you want while I put the screen down. Does it have what, sorry? Oh, local symmetry. Sorry, I did. Sorry. Yes, it has a gauge symmetry. Yeah, I can. Yeah, we can talk about the details of it. Yeah, it's if you apply one of these star operators on one of the sites, you can. This is your local gauge symmetry. So if you draw like a cross and you flip all spins associated with that cross on the site. I can show you, yeah, sorry. I can talk about this more tomorrow too. I just want to show you guys a picture and definitely like bring a lot of questions to the tutorial. We can talk about this a lot more. Sorry for going a bit fast. Yeah, sorry, Florian, I just misheard you. Sorry. Thank you.
Is that your dog?
Yeah.
Oh. Dog pigs.
Sometimes I put her in my machine learning lecture. Oh no, I'm showing you the answer. Don't look. Okay. So it's really just two slides I want to quickly show you. So just to emphasize why maybe the icing model is quite easy to study, but the gauge theory is not so obviously easy. So as some of you have kind of said already, it seems like this would be very easy to distinguish these two phases, right? So just by eye, you're looking at this and it's totally obvious that the top ones look very different from the bottom ones, right? Or you can think if I were to, you know, sum all the values here, here I'd get something close to zero and here I would get something non-zero. It seems pretty easy. So, you know, you could imagine that if you trained on these types of examples, even if I just showed you these six examples, you know, I'm sure you could tell me which one is this. Someone just shout it out. Yeah, and this one is paramagnetic, right? It's very obvious. You can learn this easily. So I just want to show you why this gauge theory is much harder. I mean, I'm not really proving it to you, but I just want you to appreciate by eye. This is two configurations. One of these corresponds to infinite temperature. So in one of these cases, I'm just choosing my spins completely at random, just plus or minus one. And in one of them, it's a topologically ordered phase. And so maybe when I opened it, I was on this slide. So if some of you saw the answer, maybe don't say. But does anyone want to guess? I'll get you guys to vote. How many of you think the topological order is on the left? How many people think it's on the right? OK, more people think it's on the right. I don't even remember the answer. Oh, yeah, you guys are right. OK. But so why did you guys think that? Is it because you knew the answer?
Network.
Yeah?
I counted the number of black squares in columns, approximately.
You counted the number of black squares where? Like around a...
In columns. So they should be the same in every column, right? Or something.
No, not in every column. No, it should get the product, so it should be like the sign of it should be the same on every column or every row.
Plaquettes should have even numbers, and this one has more of clusters.
Yeah.
Plaquettes should have even numbers, yeah. So you saw here one where the plaquette didn't have an even number?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay, cool. Nice. Okay, cool. Yeah, so I think... Also, the way this is plotted, I think, is not ideal because here, I don't have a laser pointer, but here I think you can also see cases where it looks like it's not even, but it's because the lattice is not clear on here. Like, it's not clear whether the sites are here or here. It's a little bit ambiguous the way it's plotted. So here, for example, here this almost looks like it's an odd number, but I guess the plaquette is actually here, not here. So anyway, it's a little bit hard to tell from this picture. But anyway, some of you got it wrong, some of you got it right, but I hope that just seeing this example at least emphasizes why this is a tough problem and that our neural networks are going to have a harder time. So this afternoon in the tutorial, we'll look at this example in more detail of the icing gauge theory. Okay, so see you guys this afternoon. It's at 2 in the PSI workroom.